Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. During the 1980s, comedians like Bill Murray, John Belushi, and Eddie Murphy made some of the funniest and most original comedy movies. Films like Caddyshack, The Blues Brothers, and Beverly Hills Cop are still getting laughs today. Film journalist Nick Desemlian is the author of Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Comedian Chevy Chase was one of the first Wild and Crazy Guys to break out. He left Saturday Night Live to focus on films. His departure didn't sit well with his fellow comedy titans.
The guys back in New York, people like John Belushi and Bill Murray, were kind of annoyed that he had left. They thought he had just kind of deserted them. And when he came back as guest host, there was a lot of tension in the air that whole week. And it came to a head, like, amazingly, just before Chevy Chase was about to start the show with his monologue, he and Belushi and Bill Murray got into this amazing fracas.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
They were kind of throwing punches and insults, and yeah, I mean, it was kind of an amazing story, and I got to speak to some of the people who were there that night.
Yeah, and a funny comment, what Bill Murray called Chevy.
That funny. Medium talent.
Yeah. But the strange thing is, though, as you mentioned, Chevy Chase left the SNL cast after its first season, and Bill Murray didn't join the cast until that second season. So why was there this bad blood between them? Because their careers at SNL didn't really overlap, did they?
You know, I had heard about this fight through reading some accounts of it, but I'd never heard Bill Murray talk about it. And I was dying to hear his take on it. So I asked Bill Murray, you know, what was that fight about from his perspective? And he said he was really the anointed avenging angel, I think he called himself, from the group. He was the guy who kind of felt like he had to stand up to Chevy Chase on behalf of the others. So I think he was certainly back in those days one of those guys who would throw himself into a kind of a fracas if there was something brewing and he was annoyed about something. He would just launch himself into it.
Sure. Did Chevy Chase and Bill Murray repair their relationship in time to film Caddyshack together?
Well, not as such. They did run into each other at a party, and there's a pretty funny story in the book about Chevy Chase marching up to Bill Murray, and everyone was kind of, what's going to happen? And then Chevy Chase kind of got down on his knees and unzipped Bill Murray's pants and kind of mimed, you know, doing a sexual act.
Right.
And they both the guys kind of cracked up. So they kind of, you know, there was still tension there, but not so much that they wouldn't share a scene together. And there was that legendary, iconic scene with the two of them, which wasn't actually in the script. It was kind of come up with a couple of days beforehand, where Bill's character, the kind of the crazy gardener on the golf course, has this run-in with Chevy Chase's very slick golfer.
You know, buddies for life, I think.
I'll drop by. You drop by my place anytime.
The subtitle of your book, Wild and Crazy Guys, the subtitle is How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Do you think that Bill Murray, John Belushi, Eddie Murphy, and the other comedians you write about were making a conscious effort to do something different and, so to speak, try to reinvent Hollywood movies?
I think so, definitely. I don't know if they were necessarily thinking of movies at the beginning. They all kind of came out of TV. But there was an energy, there was a sense of innovation and an unpredictability to what all of those guys were doing that was different. You know, I think comedy largely felt safe in the sort of the 50s and the 60s, and comedy in the 70s was very much kind of muted and Woody Allen doing his relationship dramas and stuff. But they brought this new kind of anarchic energy to them.
Yes, very well said. Yeah, that's the key word, anarchic. And what was going on in Hollywood at the time? What was the climate like there among the studios and the executives in the 80s that allowed them, you know, this chance to reinvent comedies and be so anarchic?
Well, the whole culture was changing, I think. I think in America in the 70s, Watergate had been going on and Vietnam was going on, and it was a very kind of dark and difficult time. When the 80s arrived and that stuff all passed, there was just a general sense of let's kind of let our hair down and let's have fun and let's have a party. I don't think the studio executives really generally knew what it was or what was going on. And if you read about Animal House, I think they were just watching going, what the hell is going on? And they had no idea whether it was gonna work or not.
Right, because it was uncharted territory. Very good point, yeah. You mentioned Animal House, and we can't really talk about this comedy renaissance of the 80s without talking about the frat comedy movie National Lampoon's Animal House. Even though it was released in 1978, it really kind of set the table for the 1980s comedy movies to come, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ivan Reitman, when I spoke to him, called it the marking point. It was it changed everything, really, because nobody expected it to blow up like it did. It made so much money. People kept going back and back to see it.
I think this situation absolutely requires an a really futile and stupid gesture be done on somebody's part.
We're just the guys to do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it!
It was like a release, I think.
Yeah.
And if you look at the movies that came out after Animal House, stuff like Caddyshack and Stripes, they're all trying to kind of capture that Animal House magic. You know,
yes.
A lot of them have that same kind of slobs versus snobs dynamic where
yes.
you've got the kind of the stuffy guys on one side and the fun-loving, crazy, anarchic guys on the other. And I really think it took everyone by surprise, including the people who made it.
Yeah. What did you think of Animal House the first time you saw it?
I mean, I love Animal House. I think elements of it have not dated too well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly some of the stuff involving, you know, gender politics and,
yes.
and the way that women are treated in it, not always good. But it has... an amazing energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly John Belushi is just unleashed in that film, and he's just so watchable.
That's the movie that made him a star, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Do you have a favorite scene in Animal House?
Gosh, any of Belushi's stuff. But, the food fight, I think, is hard to beat. Just
yeah.
as a sense of just pure hedonism, really.
Food fight!
And just as an expression of just sort of letting this energy loose, it's incredible.
Yeah, definitely. John Belushi died in 1982 after taking a speedball, a mix of cocaine and heroin. He was only 33. How do you think his career would have played out if he had not died so young?
Gosh, I mean, that's a great question. It's, he certainly wasn't expecting to die. Like, he was lining up all kinds of scripts. I mean, for one thing, he would have been in Ghostbusters. In some form, Dan Aykroyd was writing Ghostbusters for him and John Belushi as a kind of another double act thing after Blues Brothers. And the same is true of Spies Like Us. It's another project that Dan Aykroyd was writing. So it's interesting. If John Belushi had lived, we wouldn't have got Ghostbusters, you know, with Bill Murray as Venkman and the way that people love it. So who knows whether that would have actually worked or not. But I think Belushi would have done some really interesting stuff. He was talking to Robert De Niro and Sergio Leone about doing Once Upon a Time in America. Like a lot of these comedians, he wanted to kind of do some serious stuff as well as the silly stuff. So he might have turned into a really interesting dramatic actor.
Yeah. Bill Murray didn't seem very excited about starring in movies.
No.
Yeah. Why was that?
It was a combination of things. I think Bill Murray didn't want to do just pure comedy. He was really reluctant to do Ghostbusters, for one. He only did Ghostbusters if the studio would greenlight The Razor's Edge, which was the Somerset Maugham film he wanted to do. And also, he was nervous about becoming famous. He was really genuinely trepidatious. He had seen what fame had done to, like, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, and he had kind of seen it as having changed them.
Mm.
And he was really wary of that happening to him. And, when he did Ghostbusters, he did become hugely famous, massively famous all over the world, and he took 4 years off. Which is incredible. I can't think of another actor who's done that.
Yeah, especially when you're that hot. And then the fact that he was able to still come back and star in movies and make many great movies since then. What would you say was the best movie that Bill Murray made during the 1980s?
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, the first one I think of is Ghostbusters. I just think it's so hard to think of that film without thinking of Bill Murray as Peter Venkman.
Venkman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great. Actual physical contact. Can you move?
I feel so funky.
He brings such an essential quality to that film. He has that really kind of like cynical sideways glance at the whole thing.
Yeah.
He's like an audience surrogate. So however silly and big and crazy the film gets, he's kind of there to say, come on, this is a bit dumb, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think that's why the film works.
Pete Venkman's a guy who can get things done.
Right.
I wonder what makes him tick.
I wonder.
It seems to me that more than anyone else, the one comedian who really was consciously trying to change Hollywood and the entertainment industrial complex was Steve Martin. As you say in your book, throughout the 1970s, he meticulously crafted this postmodern style that Rick Moranis later described as anti-comedy. Well, what do you think?
I think meticulous is the word.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Martin was intellectual, and he would analyze comedy, and he would work on a script. You know, he worked on that script for Roxanne. It's a film I absolutely love.
Mm.
He went through draft after draft. He spent years on it, just trying to get it absolutely right. There's that brilliant scene in Roxanne where he goes into the bar, and the guy insults his nose, and he starts one-upping the guy with nose insults on different themes.
Personal.
Well, here we are. Just the three of us.
Punctual.
All right, Delman, your nose was on time, but you were 15 minutes late.
He workshopped those jokes to death. And so he was just very, very cerebral and would really, you know, not tell jokes so much as kind of do jokes about jokes.
Yeah, and meta, very meta.
Really
approach.
Meta stuff.
Yes, yes.
He was bigger than all of them in the kind of the mid-70s. He was the one stand-up who could fill arenas while the other guys were kind of getting started on Saturday Night Live. But he really struggled to take that to the big screen. The Jerk was not well received. Mm-hmm. It got really bad reviews. I think he was really hurt by that.
What did you think of it when you first saw it?
I love The Jerk. Mm-hmm. It really holds up. I think like a lot of those Steve Martin kind of late 70s, early 80s movies weren't particularly acclaimed at the time, but they really hold up. They haven't dated. The comedy is so clever, so kind of absurd.
It's like I don't fit in. It's like I don't belong here.
It's your birthday and it's time you knew. Navin, you're not a natural born child.
I'm not.
You were left on our doorstep, but we raised you like you were one of us.
You mean I'm gonna stay this color?
But it definitely deserves all the acclaim it's kind of got since.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy was a force of nature in terms of his ambition to become a star. As you say, Murphy raced after fame like a greyhound chasing a hare. He had this huge career in stand-up comedy with specials like Delirious and Raw, and it seems to me that both Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin, they were the original first rock star stand-up comedians. What was it about Eddie Murphy that made him such a great comedian?
Gosh, just charisma. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike Steve Martin, who was one character on stage, and then he would come off the stage, and people would be surprised at how quiet and shy he was.
Yeah,
Eddie Murphy was the same off stage as he was on it. You know, he was that guy who would act like a rock star on the stage, and then he would come off and party all night, and he would walk around wearing that kind of skin tight leather stuff and the medallions, and he had such a larger than life kind of persona that was just him.
Yeah.
But when he was a kid, he would go around, he would just tell everyone, I'm going to be a movie star. I'm going to be a millionaire. And he made it happen.
Yeah, and he was very young when he made it happen, wasn't he?
Really young.
Yeah.
I mean, he would ring up Saturday Night Live over and over again saying, I want to be on the show, let me be on the show. And they kept saying no, and then he kept ringing, and then eventually they let him on. And then when he got on, there was a long period where he wasn't given anything to do, but he kept at them, and eventually he got his break. So I think there was no way that Eddie Murphy wasn't going to make it happen some way or the other.
Yeah. What do you think is Eddie Murphy's best film?
Well, Beverly Hills Cop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just think the sheer swagger and the self-confidence. And to do that and be likable on top of it and not have the audience kind of turn on you.
Yeah.
You know, he's got this kind of Bugs Bunny sort of spirit.
Yeah.
He's almost like a live cartoon character.
Yeah. That's...
And he is so watchable in that film. I think that film is still electric because of him.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite scene in Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah. The legendary banana in the tailpipe scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're not going to fall for a banana in the tailpipe.
You're not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe?
It should be more natural, brother. It should flow out like this. Look, man, I ain't falling for no banana in my tailpipe. See, that's more natural for us. You've been hanging out with this dude too long.
The amount of laughs he wrings out of that whole concept, I think, is hilarious.
Yeah. Was there anything that all of these comedians had in common that allowed them to make such great comedy movies during the 1980s?
They all had this unpredictable edge to them, which I think makes them really watchable. And that's definitely true of the Blues Brothers, which is one of my favorite films of this era.
Yeah. What did you think of the Blues Brothers the first time you saw it?
It was one of the first of these films that I saw. I saw it really young. I was probably too young for that film.
How young were you? Do you remember?
I was about 7.
Oh, wow.
I was on vacation with my family in Greece. We saw it in an open-air auditorium. I remember it well. Even at that age, I thought, this is a weird film.
One, two, three, four.
This huge budget road trip musical with a car chase and heroes who have sunglasses on and you're not really sure what they're about. They're criminals, but they're eating fried chicken. It's got so much peculiar stuff going on in it, but that's what makes it brilliant. Yeah, I fell in love with that film, and I have the soundtrack on all the time, even now.
Cool. Yeah, it's a great soundtrack as well, and a great film. There were many hilarious and very talented women who appeared alongside the wild and crazy guys on SNL and SCTV, but they didn't enjoy the same notoriety and big screen success of their male colleagues. I'm thinking of people like Catherine O'Hara, Jane Curtin, and Gilda Radner. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I agree. Gilda Radner in particular, mm-hmm. I think, is it's such a shame that she didn't get some opportunities to really show her talents off on the big screen, because if you go back and rewatch those early years of Saturday Night Live, she is so hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
And her kind of characters she creates, so much imagination.
What's all this fuss I keep hearing about violins and television? Now, why don't parents want their children to see violins on television?
It was an era sort of known as New Macho, as one of the Saturday Night Live writers called it.
Yeah.
You know, from some, I think John Belushi didn't think women were particularly funny, so I think that fed into it, unfortunately. But yeah, it's a big shame.
Dan, there's an old saying. Behind every successful man, there's a woman, a loving, giving, caring woman. But you wouldn't know about that, Dan, because there's no old saying about what's behind a miserable failure.
Let's finish up, Nick, with our lightning round of short snappers. Kind of free association, if you're up for that?
Sure.
Okay, so who was the funniest of the guys we've talked about?
Gosh, well, I'm gonna go for Steve Martin. He is just the master of comedy, I think. Steve Martin, there's nothing he can't do. He's just so hilarious.
Yeah. Who was the wildest of the wild and crazy guys?
I mean, it has to be Belushi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who was the craziest?
If we're talking eccentricity, I don't like using the word crazy too much.
Okay,
but
the most
in terms of eccentricity, I think Dan Aykroyd is hard to beat, and it's a wonderful eccentricity. I've had the chance to speak to him many times, and he's got the most incredible brain, just one of the most amazing encyclopedic brains, and he is so passionate about so many things, and he's a joy to talk to. But yeah, very eccentric.
Stripes or National Lampoon's Vacation?
National Lampoon's Vacation for me.
Why?
Well, it's one of my favorite Chevy Chase. I think a lot of Chevy Chase films didn't work in the 80s, but I think Clark Griswold was just the perfect character for him.
Yeah, I think I know the answer to this next one, but I'm going to ask anyway. Caddyshack or Blues Brothers?
Yeah, Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Fletch or Ghostbusters?
Ghostbusters. Yeah, I do like Fletch a lot, but there's no arguing with Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Animal House or Meatballs?
Animal House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beverly Hills Cop or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Oh, man. That's the hardest.
Yeah.
Oh, because, I love both of those films.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'll take Planes, Trains, and Automobiles because it's just a perfect film, I think. And it's fascinating that you're kind of sympathies change as you watch it. To start with, John Candy's playing this super annoying guy called Dell, who is annoying you as the person watching it, and then you shift and you think Steve Martin's a bit of an a** for not treating him better, and you're ping-ponging back and forth in between who you're kind of relating to, and then by the end you just love both of them.
Yeah, and then there's, as you broke this story in your book, there's this line that John Candy ad-libs that still, when Steve Martin thinks about it, still brings a tear to his eye. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of improvisation in a scene that didn't actually make it into the film. But it's Del, the John Candy character, talking about his dead wife and saying, "This time I just couldn't let go." And, you know, in the film, it's heartbreaking. He's still carrying the picture of his wife around with him. And gradually, you see that this kind of obnoxious buffoon is actually this heartbroken guy who you just love by the end. And the end of that film makes me tear up as well. So I'm not surprised that, you know, Steve Martin had that.
Nick DeSemlian is the author of Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Find out more and maybe get into a
food fight
at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Vivian Goldman, William Sanderson, and Nick DeSemlian. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, why not subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods? And please make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
He hates these cans! Stay away from the cans!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
On my honor, with Almighty God as my witness, I am not an angel dust dealer.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I once knew a guy who could have been a great golfer.
Could have gone pro. Decided to go to college instead.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Oh, nice shooting, Tex.